open public input. I know there's a number of first-timers here in terms of public input. It's 3 minutes. You'll hear a beeper go off and wind up your thoughts shortly thereafter. Then I'll give you a verbal or a nonverbal indication, something like that. But we have to keep it. We do have a lot of folks that do want to talk. And I apologize beforehand if I mispronounced your name. But as they say, if you were all Smiths, it would be easy. But so I'm going to call you up two at a time and then just rotate that. So the first two will be Casey McLean and Jeff Friedman, please. And then, yeah, pull the mic up when you do talk. Thank you. We're on TVW, so you'll be a star now.
Oh, great.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm concerned about declining salmon stocks, and I'm concerned about declining southern resident killer whale numbers. I'm even more concerned that the commission is considering culling pinnipeds as a solution to these problems. Culling is not a successful strategy for managing wildlife populations, and we have proven that time and time again. As a management approach, lethal removal rarely produces its desired outcome and often has unintended consequences. Bowen and Liggard in 2012, reviewed 107 scientific publications on culling and determined these programs rarely have measurable objectives with respect to prey and no evaluations of outcomes. What scientific measures would the Fish and Wildlife Commission use to determine the success of culling? Who's going to fund and do the follow-up to monitor for success? What will we gain scientifically from this culling? Necropsy and diet research should be done on each animal to advance our understanding of the species. In Norway, they killed 700 killer whales to protect herring for over 21 years, and it was not successful. We have to learn from others. Culls are not successful if they're not maintained, and once they stop, things go back to the way they were. Does the state have the financial resources to be a serial culler? We can't proceed on a feeling of what may help. There has to be a way to differentiate between the feeling and what will actually help. That's done through science. We don't have that science to date. Prey are limited by their habitat, just like salmon are. If we remove the predators, it has little effect to help that prey. There have been much larger populations of marine mammals in the past, so we cannot assume that large populations of marine mammals automatically means less prey. A decision to cull should be based on larger ecosystem effects and science. Killing pinnipeds to help salmon will disrupt the environment in ways we cannot predict right now. Ford et al. Says that transient killer whales are increasing in numbers, and the conservative estimate is that they're eating over 1,000 seals per year. They're doing a better job than we ever could. What if the transient numbers begin to decline if you cull the seals? As seals are generalists, they eat over 57 species of fish, including predators of salmon smolts. What if we cull the seals and those predators increase and salmon decrease? What then? In the complex food web graphic you have in your presentation, where are the dams, the forest practices, the cities, the 8 million people, and climate change? It's a fish and pinniped food web, not an ecosystem model that we need. Has the commission considered the cost, the public outcry, and the potential lawsuits that could be generated from something like this? I would hate to see the Fish and Wildlife Commission take action to move forward without respecting the time and energy that the governor's task force has put into their recommendations and without actually doing the science to see if what people feel may help will actually help. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Casey. Well said. And when you do come up, please, before you start talking, just say your name just for the record.
I apologize.
Thank you. Yes, Commissioner McCarthy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony. We've received a lot of written input on this very matter. Do you believe that pinnipeds are a problem with regard to killer whale prey relationships? And if you do, do you have any suggestions for addressing the problem other than culling?
I don't believe that the pinnipeds are the limiting factor. I do believe it's a multifaceted problem for sure, but I firmly believe that the government or the governor's task force recommendations are what's going to actually produce the results that we all want, which is more salmon and to keep our killer whales.
Thank you. Martha Jordan, please. And Jeff.
Morning. Good morning. My name is Jeff Friedman. I am an owner of a whale watching company in Friday Harbor. I'm also the U.S. president of the Pacific Whale Watch Association, and also I serve on the governor's Southern Resident Killer Whale Recovery Task Force. And I want to urge extreme caution in the approach to and discussions on pinniped management, and would request the engagement of an independent science panel that would also include some killer whale experts as well. There's a lot of scientific uncertainty with this. We know we need a healthy pinniped population to prey on some of the predators of salmon. They keep some of the salmon predators in check. But mostly what I'm here to talk about is the huge increase in the number of transient orcas that we see in these waters now, that are now probably about, I would say, around 80% or more of our whale watching tours. The transient orcas have always been in these waters, but it's really in the last 3 to 5 years that we are seeing a huge spike in their numbers. And I think if we look at the numbers of pinnipeds that are in Hood Canal, in Puget Sound, in the inland waters, I think we're going to see that those numbers are already decreasing. And we see an incredible amount of hunting on seals and sea lions on a daily basis on our tours. The transients, their population is growing around 4 to 6% a year. We have more transient killer whales right now under the age of 7 than we do southern resident killer whales. These are all new and growing mouths to feed. We are also seeing families of transients that have typically spent most of their time off the West Coast that are now coming into the inland waters in increasing numbers. I believe in 2018 we're going to show more than 600 different sightings of transient orcas. And they are the most efficient lethal removal program that we could possibly design. And the dinner bell has rung. They are working this issue, and they are going to be bringing a balance to the pinniped population. And I think we should just let them do their jobs and see how this recent increase plays out. And having served on the governor's task force for southern residents, I absolutely do not want to be back in 10 years serving on another task force trying to figure out how to recover the transient orcas because we got involved in the balance between them and their food. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. And also, having served on the task force, I appreciated your comments and learned from them during our meetings.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Lawrence Buckland. And now we will switch from marine critters to
feathers.
Birds. Feathers. Martha.
I'm Martha Jordan with the Northwest Swan Conservation Association. So a couple of things. One, I just want you all to know that I'm really working closely with the agency now under a small contract to help the agency do those things that we ran into problems with last year, and updating protocols for what the staff and others on the SWAN team, which we've formed for so many decades, actually do, so that we can better have a thing in place for us to be able to tell the public what we're really doing and have our protocols that we've been using for catching swans, transporting swans, who deals with the swans, rehabilitation. It's just the whole gamut of how we deal with this lead poisoning and power line collisions and all those other things that happen to birds. So we have a couple of things. One is that last year we ended up with about 18,481 swans in our northern counties from Pierce County all the way through Skagit, Whatcom. And that was down about 1,500 swans from the year before, but we think they're up in Canada. So really we're into this zone where in western Washington we've probably got 21,000 trumpeter swans. We've probably got about 19,000 trumpeters, and that's two-thirds of the entire Pacific Coast population wintering in Washington, mostly western Washington. then we have our tundra swans. And so what's happening right now with Kyle Spragans, the waterfowl manager, is we're doing a citizen science project launch, because right now we currently have a problem with snow geese really moving out all over the state in larger numbers than have ever happened before. We're seeing them in new places in larger numbers, like 1,000 in Carnation. It's never, ever seen anything like that. So we've launched a citizen science project with the agency in the lead on that, and that is kind of moving forward, and you'll hear more about that. I gave you a newsletter about what we've been doing, not only with the agency, but out in the public, and a lot of public outreach. The staff that you have is doing an excellent job in working with these waterfowl issues, and especially the lead poisoning issues up at Judson. So this week, the mortality factors are 80 swans in total right now. 43 of those are power lines, 27 are power lines, 43 are lead. Other traumas, undetermined, is about 6, and then we have some feather piles, which we don't know. So in all, we have about 80 swans that are now known as mortality. The reality here is that we're seeing an uptick in lead, but we're not sure why. We've got issues up at Judson Lake, which is the ongoing issue that's been plaguing the agency for so long, and we're trying to figure it out. So right after this meeting, I'm meeting with staff again, and we're going to start talking about how we prioritize, how we deal with these major issues, which we're also seeing more lead poisoning. Last year, we had a lead poisoning incident at Taps Lake. Turns out that it was a water level issue, and it was fishing sinkers and broken glass. But, yeah.
Thank you, Martha.
Yeah.
So always appreciated. David Lynn, please, and Lawrence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioners. Thank you again for being able to be in front of you to talk about Point No Point. I'm not going to go through the whole history of that, other than to say that the Commission had a briefing from staff in December of 2015, and that included a copy of then-Director Unsworth's letter to the Corps asking them to proceed with evaluating and hopefully signing off on a permit for the ramp portion of that facility, for which we have about $4 million sunk into. It's the boat launch to nowhere. The U.S. Corps of Engineers responded on 7 January 2016 and said that they were moving forward with reviewing the application. That's 3 years ago. We still don't have a response. After 2 years with no action, I came back. We have an ad hoc committee that has been meeting with staff. And as you may remember, in August, I came before you, brought this to your attention, and you asked the director to bring himself up to speed, which brings us up to current. The director and Larry Phillips have met with objecting tribal members, as I understand it, and that meeting was not fruitful. Thank you both for your efforts. I'm glad to see that we're moving forward, at least with overtures, which brings me to the Corps of Engineers and Mr. Phillips having reached out to them, asking for a status, and as of recently, there's been no definitive answer from the Corps, so I'm here to just bring you up to speed as the ad hoc committee understands it, and to request that staff and the commission do what's necessary to push this over the top and either get the Corps to deny the permit, which is appealable, or issue the darn thing and we can move on. And with that, I'm almost done. For those of you from the area, we have a severe access problem to Puget Sound. Right now, the two launches that were in Pierce County that were south of the Narrows have been closed to public use. And the only, well, you have to go from Point Defiance to Browns Point. Those are the two access points, all tied deep water access points. That's a significant distance. So I'll just beat on that a little bit. Okay, thank my you. Time's up. Thank you.
Thank you, Lawrence. Commissioner Baker.
Hi. Here.
Oh. Yep.
I am from the area, and I'd like to ask this question, but I feel the need to preface it, which is not to say there's not a judgment call behind the question. It's a true question. Trying to follow Point over the years, my question is there a time when, in order to get access, we start looking at other accesses and stop fighting and stop throwing good money after bad? That's actually my question. Is that something that you and the committee are thinking about?
Well, that has been thrown out as a possibility, but the question that would be raised is, we've gone through all of the other bureaucratic hurdles in terms of endangered species review, mitigation review for that site, mitigation projects, and the question becomes, how would the nature of the tribes, and specifically talking about the Suquamish, how would their objections be altered with a near to Point No Point site? It's access and additional boats on the water that they perceive would adversely impact their tribal rights. If you move 3 miles down the beach, you're really not changing that paradigm.
Thank you. Yes.
I would like to point this to Kelly. See if you got opportunity to look at this yet, Kelly.
Gave a good update. We met with tribal leaders from Suquamish. That was not a productive meeting. Hoped to get a little more movement, and we did not. And now we're looking to the Corps to move them along in their permitting decision. So I think that was an accurate update.
Thank you. We don't take public. No. That's okay.
You can go sign in.
Karen, you can sign up to testify if you want, sir. Karen Kevler, please, and David Lynn.
Good morning. My name is David Lynn from Ocean Shores, and I'm here representing myself. First, I'd like to thank Director Suswin for coming out to Montesano last month to meet with folks in our part of the state. That's always a good thing to have that direct interaction and be able to convey our thoughts and interests. So thanks for being there. On my most recent visits to the commissioners' meetings, I have spoken about problems that I have found with the wolf protocol, which resulted in the unnecessary killing of wolves. Today, I'd like to point out just one more that I have found in my reviews of incident reports by the department staff. There's a report on September 6th that records the injury of one calf in the old Profanity Peak territory in Ferry County. In addition to describing the injury sustained by the calf, the report notes that, quote, cattle located within rendezvous site of wolves occupying old territory of Profanity Pack, end quote. This depredation was one of those used by Director Suswind in justifying his lethal removal order on September 12th. I think that any reasonable person would conclude that a depredation that occurs at a wolf rendezvous site is a human problem, not a wolf problem. I have found this type of situation to occur over and over again, where poor grazing management creates these dangerous situations. The department needs to step up its monitoring of grazing practices and place stricter requirements on ranchers before a depredation is counted toward the lethal removal of wolves. Now, shifting gears, at our meeting in Montesano, Director Suswin mentioned that he would like to see the department's constituency expand beyond just the traditional hunting and fishing enthusiasts. I believe that there is a large group of environmentalists in the state who could provide that sort of support for the department's activities. By reorienting its thinking, the department could utilize the skills and ideals of the environmental community to further its mission. Rather than fighting lawsuits from environmental groups, the department could collaborate with them to the benefit of all the citizens of the state. As for myself, I would rather pay taxes to support the department than to contribute money to organizations that fund litigation against it. At the Monsanto meeting, someone raised the issue of the proposed dam on the Chehalis River near PL. This dam would negatively impact salmon habitat and should be of concern to the department. While there are environmental reviews, public comments, and other factors to be considered, I think the department itself should weigh in on how this proposal would affect its fisheries. Also, as others have mentioned, the governor's task force on orcas has issued a number of recommendations impacting salmon populations, including culvert removal, repairs, compliance with existing state and federal habitat laws, breaching the lower Snake River dams, increased spill of water over the Columbia and Snake River dams, and ban on whale watching of the southern resident whales. I think all of these ideas are some that both the department and the environmental groups could support and should work, find ways to cooperate on. I think the department should become more actively engaged in opposing the Chehalis River Dam and in supporting the governor's proposals to save the orca population. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Rick Cook, please, and Karen.
Hi, my name is Karen Rumors-Kleven. I live in Friday Harbor, San Juan County, and I came here to talk to you about the proposal to kill pinnipeds throughout the Salish Sea. The Port of Friday Harbor has a tourist attraction not many can actually claim. We have Popeye, and she has been our resident female seal for 30 years. We love her so much. We even have a statue of her in our marine water park, Front Park, and every year she proudly presents us her new baby. Her offspring lives in and around the harbor, and so we had a very significant population developing. They had a pretty easy life, and the population grew, but guess who came to town a few years ago? Exactly at the same time that Jeff Friedman described that the trenchants were coming more frequently in our area. They have been dining at the Port of Friday Harbor a lot. I would sit on Limekiln Point trying to wait to see a whale, and I would get a text that, by golly, the whales are all of a sudden right next to my boat in Port of Friday Harbor, and are the trenchants after the seals. Mothers were teaching their babies how to silently attack a pinniped. To see them make a kill is an awe-inspiring experience, and after the kill, they leave a huge mess of seal guts that is feeding all the critters in the environment and supports nature. So to me, that is the picture of an ecosystem in balance. There's a proposal to kill the pinnipeds to save the salmon, but a lot of people really don't know much more about them. What a marine biologist do know is that the seals eat over 60 species of fish. Less known is the fact that many seals have become specialists. So one eats salmon over here, but the other one over there eats hake. They both look the same. We don't know who fishes for what species in what area. So here we go out killing the seals, and we may just kill the hake specialist. It's known that when the seal population is down, the hake population is up and the herring population collapses. So why? Seals eat hake. Hake eats herring. Juvenile salmon only have 3 forage fish to choose from, and one of them is herring. Too much hake and the juvenile salmon population suddenly collapses. We are the cause of the demise of the southern killer whales. Let us not kill their cousins by an ill-advised call for control of pinnipeds. The risk for unintended consequences is just too high. We humans don't have a good track record for managing nature. We need to leave it to the trenchants to do that job. We have seen what happens to whales when you take all their food. Let's not repeat the same mistake twice. Let's not kill the trenchants too. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Doug Hieromas and Rick.
Hi, I'm Rick Cook. Morning, and thanks for the opportunity to talk. I have a couple of items that I'd like to cover and have the Commission and Fish and Wildlife consider. First is a surplus of salmon that arrive at the hatchery and what's done with them. Current practices, from what I've observed, is these surplus salmon are packed in totes, and they're sold to a fish processing company. That's great for revenue. Those surplus salmon are actually, those carcasses can become the fertilizer that smolts need for, you know, in the environment. So anyway, my suggestion is that at least 50% of those, or some larger number, be released, you know, taken upriver through a you know, volunteer program. I'm sure there's plenty of volunteers that will do it, you know, and put back in the system to allow that fertilizer, so to speak, to help this mulch. I think it's proven science that stuff works. Second item, kind of to offset the revenue loss that would cause, is to change the two-pole enhancement program. Instead of having one program that covers certain areas across the state, have each area have its own fee for two-pole enhancement, and expand that two-pole enhancement to the entire system. So, for instance, Columbia, allow two-pole enhancements all the way through all the tributaries. So what if fishermen are using two poles instead of one? They might be catching more fish. That's kind of part of why they're out there. I don't think it's hurting anything. So if you had one for the Columbia system, Willapa, Grace Harbor, the Straits, Puget Sound, I'll use Grace Harbor as an example. That's an area that I frequently go to. You have that two-pole enhancement that would pay my extra $10 or whatever it ends up being just for that area. And I can use two poles in the Hump Tulips or in the Satsup, not just in the Chehalis. So I think that revenue, I think fishermen would like that. Recreational sportsmen would like that. It's more cost. I'm going to buy at least two of them as a recreational fisherman. So anyway, those are just a couple of suggestions that I would like the Fish and Wildlife to consider. And thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, sir. Thanks for your testimony. As far as the issue of using surplus for nutrients, I can tell you that that does go on in Hood Canal with at least one of the hatcheries that I'm familiar with, Chum Hatchery at McKernan Hatchery. And it's a very good program the department has, and I assume it's still ongoing. And that is, and I forget the name of the group, but it is a volunteer group, Youth Conservation Corps, I believe, was the name of it. And it's a good situation where the department needs, when these fish return, at the hatchery to gather the eggs. They need bodies. They need volunteers. And so this youth conservation group comes and provides that service. And in exchange for that, they are given, or the group is given, some carcasses for nutrient. And as I recall, it was for bull trout in the Olympic Park. So, I mean, that is ongoing. I'm not sure if you were aware of it, but it is a practice, and I would imagine that it could be expanded in other hatcheries and other areas. So just wanted to make you aware of it.
Yeah, I would hope that practice would be expanded, because from what I've seen, the Hump Tulips is an example. That's the place I fish. It doesn't really happen there. They get put in totes, and they're sold, and I understand the revenue. The department needs revenue for sure, so there's some ways to offset that. But appreciate it.
And I am aware also that some of the regional fish enhancement groups do that on a voluntary basis.
Yep.
But thank you. Appreciate your comments. Michael Schmidt, please, and Doug.
Thank you. My name is Doug Hieronymus. I'm an avid fisherman. Fish a lot. I live on one of the Grays Harbor Rivers, and actually fish on my log 93 days last year. I
have to learn from you.
Doesn't mean I catch that much, but I still fish a lot. I took the opportunity to attend a Meet the Director meeting out in Montesano a month and a half ago. Very good. Appreciate you doing that. That was good for the community and good for us to see that. I'm here today to talk about the pinniped topic and the focus groups that are currently going on in the Puget Sound and the Columbia River. I want to bring up that I can't seem to find anybody that's focusing and trying to study or see what the issues related to the Willapa Harbor and the Grays Harbor. That's where I focus most of my attention there, and I've seen dramatic increase over the years, and it's so bad. I mentioned at that meeting I went to that I can go up and fish for the day, and I, you know, sometimes I'm fortunate I get out of there early. But no matter what time I leave the river, when I go down to the boat launch, and I get where the tidal part of the river is, and the non-tidal there, where the deep part of the river meets the actual riverbed in the shallow spots, there's always a congregation of sea lions, the California sea lions, and you can pull over and I do it time and time, just sit and watch, and it's, you cannot go 5 minutes without seeing a sea lion grab a fish, take it up and thrash it and break it in half, and seagulls are trying to get the parts, and there's an obvious increase in a problem. So I don't know what the solution is, but I just want to try to get some focus to those areas. And I looked at your presentation for a little bit later on the pinnipeds, and on page 13 there's a map, and that map shows the areas have been studied, and there's no points or data related to those two harbors. So just want to ask to try to get some focus on those areas.
Thank you.
Appreciate the time.
Duly noted. Dr. Deborah Giles, please, and Michael.
My name is Michael Schmidt. I'm the Deputy Director for Long Live the Kings, a nonprofit devoted to salmon recovery and sustainable fisheries. Since 2014, Long Live the Kings and the Pacific Salmon Foundation of Vancouver, BC, have been coordinating the Salish Sea Marine Survival Project. This international effort is to determine why juvenile Chinook, coho, and steelhead are not doing well as they traverse the Salish Sea Marine environment. It's a collaborative effort with 60 state, tribal, federal, private, academic, and NGOs involved, including the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, who plays a major role in the effort. we reported to the commission a couple years ago on the steelhead portion of this effort, and it's still ongoing. To date, over $20 million has been invested in about 90 ecosystem studies throughout the Salish Sea. This includes some of the seal research you're going to hear about today. The science is suggesting harbor seals are playing a substantial role in Chinook mortality in Puget Sound, and we agree it's an important issue to contend with. However, we ask you that you keep in mind the following as you listen today. We're learning there are likely several factors affecting Chinook survival, and their impacts are likely cumulative. Limited estuary habitat, contaminants, variation in prey for those Chinook, low abundance of herring and Pacific sand lance, competition with pink salmon, and hatchery rearing and release strategies all may be playing a role. When considering how to address the impacts of harbor seals, we ask that you maintain an ecosystem perspective. Past and new research have brought additional hypotheses to the forefront, suggesting that low abundance of forage fish, migration barriers like the Hook Canal Bridge or Ballard Locks, artificial haulouts, and the consolidation of hatchery release timing across the Salish Sea could exacerbate these problems, the predation issue. We agree you must not wait too long to act, but we ask that you support the department and their partners in their process to collect and refine the data that will help define a path forward. Ongoing and proposed studies will help clarify the level of impact seals are having, where we should be most concerned, and what options from an ecosystem perspective we may have for addressing this issue. Finally, we ask that any action you pursue to increase the number of Chinook returning to Puget Sound, you continue the science, you monitor the effectiveness, and you adjust accordingly based on the results. In ecosystem management, all actions are experiments. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Yes, Commissioner Carpenter.
One of the items that you raised was the reduction in forage fish,
yep.
Sand lances and herring.
Yep.
And my life's been spent all up in the northern part of our, up in God's country, the San Juan Islands, I guess, and I can tell you, from a participant out on the water for 60-some years, the food source that I'm most familiar with, sand lance and herring, has reduced dramatically. And I'm very concerned about it. I raise it too often, I guess, probably. And I'm just concerned about, do you folks have any data that would show, in theory, the reduction in that type of forage? For salmon and other stocks, or are we just, is it just an opinion? Do we know what's truly going on out there, or do we need to engage and find out sooner than later? It wasn't very many years ago, Director, that in La Conner, and I don't know what the department called it, but they had a forage fish group that worked out of the La Conner Marina. They did trawl surveys, acoustical surveys up in the North Sound, and they provided abundance data. I'm just concerned that we're not doing that and what our trend is, and if it's going the wrong direction, I don't know how we can fix some of these things if we don't provide enough food.
Are you looking for a response to that? Sorry. It got rhetorical in a hurry.
I did.
Yeah. So, yes, I'd say there's a substantial information, of course, that the forage fish populations have declined. Some recent pulses of anchovy in the system have provided some interesting information about what happens when you have a lot of forage fish in the system, and we're trying to learn from that. So,
thank you. Aaron Shotton, please.
Scotton.
Sorry. Dr. Giles.
My name is Dr. Deborah Giles, and I'm the science and research director for a nonprofit called Wild Orca, and the science advisor for the Orca Salmon Alliance. This year, I've had the honor of serving on the governor's task force working groups for both prey and vessels. I'm here today speaking on behalf of Wild Orca, as well as Friends for the San Juans and Cindy Hansen from Orca Network. In large part, I could just say ditto to what he said, but I'll go ahead and read my comments. Pinnipeds provide an easy scapegoat for declining Chinook salmon populations. Food webs are complicated, so it's not surprising that some want to simplify the predator-prey relationships, but we are at a crossroads right now, and it's important to recognize that calling a top predator could have unintended consequences that we haven't considered. In order to get a handle on the myriad causes of salmon declines, we need to be laser-focused on protecting and restoring entire ecosystems from California to Alaska, and we need to be a lot better at limiting and mitigating our own impacts to fisheries in order to better protect salmon and the ecosystems they rely on. There is a distinct need for additional data before a decision can be made to cull pinnipeds, especially in the Salish Sea, such as fecal analysis to determine diet. Prominent marine mammal researchers Dr. Lance Barrett Leonard and Peter Ross have stated that there has been virtually no change in seal numbers in BC in more than 20 years. Previous studies have shown that less than 4% of harbor seal diet is salmon. 40% of harbor seal diet is hake, which is a predator on juvenile salmon. Nearly 500,000 seals were killed in the Salish Sea between 1879 and 1968. Their numbers plummeted to less than one-tenth of their pre-exploitation numbers. Numbers have been relatively stable since the 1990s at roughly 110,000. A recently published paper by Wieland et al. Examines increased transient killer whale presence in the Salish Sea. The data from this paper was taken from whale sightings from the Orca Network and the Pacific Whale Watchers Association and shows that transients are consuming a significant number of pinnipeds, 1,000 or more per year. This number is a conservative figure. As mentioned by other speakers today, we need to take the needs of the marine mammal eating killer whales into consideration when considering the decision to cull pinnipeds. This ecotype of killer whale is increasing at a healthy rate, and they are serving to keep the seal population in check without any human intervention. Thank you for taking my comments.
Thank you very much. Tom Davis, please. And Aaron Scotton.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and I'd like to start out. Director came and visited us in Eastern Washington and has done so numerous times. I think it's four, somewhere in there. But we really appreciate you taking the time to come out and talk to us, and I guess that's kind of what I'm here for today. I think we've hit a point, and I wanted to update the committee. We need to have a bottom-up type of atmosphere in Northeast regarding wolves instead of a top down, and I think that sentiment rang true through multiple meetings, the WEG again this week, that there's a lot of misinformation that comes out regarding how the grazing season goes. There's misinformation regarding what the ranches are doing. That might be messaging, I'm not sure, but I think that we have such a convoluted and difficult system to navigate right now. Decisions are being made that should be on the ground by the moment, and we have to wait for those to come to Olympia, be digested, processed through, regurgitated, brought back over. And by then, that situation has changed. It's not even relevant anymore. So I guess pretty simple. I would like to see the commission support the director in getting the ability to start having more local and community organized objectives being handled. I worry sometimes on the wording I use, so I apologize, but it seems like anymore if you say the wrong word, that's what gets picked on instead of the message. But I would like to see that support go to the director. I think we've talked, and I feel like we had some receptivity to getting more local activity, listening to the locals, and not just going with hearsay, rumors, and incorrect information. So I'll leave it at that before I get grumpy.
Thank you, Aaron. Yes. Commissioner McCarthy.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wonder if you could give us an example of the misinformation that you spoke to several times. What's an example of that that's troubling to you?
Well, we'll use the one that you heard this morning, and I can't tell you because I don't navigate through technology very well in any way, shape, or form, but apparently on the website in the release from WDFW is that cattle were in a rendezvous location, and the reality of that is that rendezvous location changed into where the cattle were already at. This year, the rendezvous location changed three different times, and we watched that occur. And I don't know how that comes out. Could it be by the time it gets here and then gets through the release, it's wrong? Does it start off incorrect? But the staff on the ground, we all had talked. We knew what had happened and how that transition had occurred. We even have a pretty good reason why it occurred. But that didn't seem to translate when it gets released to the public. The next one would be, and this is messaging that we had talked about. So the message comes out, we have to use lethal. It's a last resort because non-lethal failed. Well, if non-lethal failed because a cow and wolf interacted, and the expectation is that that will never happen, that's an unattainable goal, and it's one that sets everyone up for failure. This is a wild landscape. It's nature, and it's going to be fluid, and it's going to have movement to it. And you could interlock arms, and still you have the potential of a wolf making it through. It's not the wolf's fault. It's people's fault for the messaging. It's people's fault for the way that they're presenting this and the expectations that they're putting forward, which goes back to my original request. If we could start getting some local community, that's where it starts. And then that partnership, and that is a key word, partnership, starts to translate up and down and becomes more fluid instead of it feeling like it's a top-down, and not just top-down, but Olympia to staff to rancher. Even the staff and the rancher may be on the same page, but if Olympia makes a decision, that's just the way it goes. And there's a decision being made, and I don't know even at what level, but that provides that misinformation and bad messaging.
Thank you.
Well stated.
That's why he's going to laugh. I got the opportunity to meet Aaron this summer, and we've stayed in touch and talked on a real regular basis. He always says he's not good at messaging, but he's really good at messaging. And there again, back to the point I tried to make earlier. There's a lot of heavy lifting to be done. Aaron's got big old broad shoulders, and we got to rely on him because he is out there amongst them. He knows what he's doing. He sees what is going on. And there again, back to the bottom up, top down, we all got to work together on this deal because he's got a wealth, and Jay Shepherd's hiding somewhere back there. And these guys have a wealth of information. They're truly committed to making this work. They know. They're smart. They understand that the wolves are on
the landscape and are going to remain on the landscape. What these guys are trying to do is keep the communities whole in that part of the world. And it isn't just that part of the world, because our pack where we're at, we're one depredation away from having to do something. And is it right? No, but there again, we've got to try and learn some lessons, because it isn't just you. It is unique to Northeast right at the moment, but this is going to be unique to the whole state. So we need to work with these guys, because it isn't going to go away. It's just going to keep ratcheting up. So, no, thanks for being part of the team, Aaron.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I just want to add my thanks, Sarah, and I always appreciate when you come talk to us. And just introduce, your anecdotes were great. I think, you know, telling the story from the community. I want to introduce a term that we really need to bring into this discussion, and it's trust. I mean, we need to trust the local communities who are on the ground dealing day in and day out with this, and trust their knowledge. I mean, just the stories that you told, phenomenal amount of experience and knowledge. And the thing that I just keep thinking is, you know, cattlemen are in a business, and their business are their animals. They don't want to be losing those animals. You know, trust them to figure out how to protect them. Thank you again for coming, and I just keep that word in front of this whole discussion as we're going on. It's real important.
Seems you were good at messaging today.
Urgency.
Thank you. Very much. Not just today. You're good at it all the time. And Robert Sudar, please. And Tom, you ready?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. I hate to follow a guy like that. Tom Davis, Washington Farm Bureau. Not here to talk to you about wolves this morning, but I do want to support what he had to say, and thank the director, the commission, for maintaining implementation of the protocol through this grazing season. It was a hard one. And what happened in September with a couple of our fellow members of the WAG asking for a timeout during a really challenging time to ask for that timeout really put stress on the Wolf Advisory Group, which we're still needing to work through. But they raised some points that we need to talk about, the ones that asked for the timeout. But at the same time, we needed to protect our ranch families. And I appreciate the director for maintaining the work of the protocol. What I want to talk to you about is something completely different, and it has to do with wildlife damage on crops. And a situation arose this year that I was not familiar with, and it raised, I think, it may be an issue that I hope you'll consider for amending your WAC relating to wildlife damage. The situation is in Buckley, which is just outside of Enumclaw there. There's land that's owned by DSHS, which I didn't know DSHS owned any farm ground, but they do, and we have a farmer, a member of the Farm Bureau, who is raising Chinese cabbage on that. And I guess that's a valuable crop. I don't tend to eat Chinese cabbage, but there obviously some people love it, and they'll pay a lot of money for it. And the elk came in and did a lot of damage, tune of about $140,000. Went to file a claim with the department, started the process, and then the staff correctly pointed to the WAC that says damage claims aren't paid for damage that occurs on public land. So we have a problem, $140,000 worth of damage to this family farm crop, and simply because it's on DSHS land. The same could be true for if they were farming on department land, DNR land. DNR owns over 1 million acres of prime farm ground across the state. So we have a situation here that I think needs to be addressed. I've talked to Dan Brinson, who is, he wasn't in his current role when that WAC was updated. For whatever reason, I think there was a reason why staff brought that for your consideration when you updated the WAC back in 2017. But I would appreciate your consideration for an adjustment to that, just at least consider it, because it's maybe narrowing down that scope, not making it all public lands, but maybe if it's department lands, lands that are raised for, you know, wildlife enhancement, but for our family farmers, that's a real problem. So appreciate your consideration of that.
Thanks, Tom Holman. Mr. Baker?
Is the land in question in your example, does that farmer lease or otherwise have a contractual relationship between him and his family and DSHS? And my real question is whether money changes hands. Is he paying to farm that land?
So he is, yes.
Good point.
Wait.
Yes.
So I see Joe scribbling down. You bring up an interesting point. I'm curious as to whether there's some policy implications for that specific omission of public lands. And there may be. And I think at a minimum, the commission should be an update on that. It's an interesting issue, and there may be a reason behind it that we're not aware of as we sit here today. So,
and I believe there was a reason, but I'm thinking maybe that language is just maybe more broad than they want it to be when they brought it forward. It's WAC 220, 440, 220, 440, 140, sub 11, specifically.
And there again, Tom mentioned that DNR is, and they are actually acquiring farm ground, so they're on the increase because they're, again, for school grounds in our part of the world, they're getting away from timber and going more towards farm ground. In a lot of the department ground, yeah, on the leases there's crop edges left for game and this, that, and the other, but they're, again, on DNR. Most of those are pretty much straight-up leases. It doesn't matter whether you're leasing it from the DNR or from Joe Schmuck that owns the ground, because in ag, there's a lot of lease ground anymore. So I think, like Tom said, there's variables in leases and stuff, but I think this is just one that fell in the cracks would be my guess, and I think it should be something that was definitely looked at. Because in most of those contracts, if there is, wildlife type deal, Slays had department ground leased for 100 years, and that was the deal. It was an in-kind thing. They got to farm the farm ground, and then they couldn't ask for compensation on their private ground. So I think it's something that could be looked at and definitely be addressed, because that's a whack $140,000 that nobody should have to shoulder.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
And Colleen Weiler, please. And Robert.
Rob Sudar, commercial advisor. I don't mean to bring the Columbia River into today's discussion, but I have to be on Willapa tomorrow for the Christmas bird count. I've been the compiler there for a lot of years, and so I can't come to Olympia. So I'm here today. On the way up, I heard that this was the sixth anniversary of the Sandy Hook shooting. And I remember on the morning of that, I was driving to Olympia to comment on this policy in its early stages. So we've been dealing with it for that long. And what I said that day is probably not much different than what I would say today, except that what I was predicting is what I have to talk about today. So in looking at your press release for this conversation, you said that it was designed to promote orderly fisheries. We already had orderly fisheries. I mean, we don't have disorderly fisheries on the Columbia River. If anything, they become more disorderly with this policy in terms of inabilities to stay within impact rates as you've shifted these allocations. So we already had those in place. Wild steelhead conservation, the review has shown that there is no conservation benefit in this policy beyond what was already there. Economic stability for the fisheries, there's no doubt this policy has had a terrible effect on the economics of our industry. Strategies in allocating more salmon to the sports fishery, well, you did manage to accomplish that. I mean, that's the one thing that's happened is we've lost allocation. We've completely lost some of our fisheries, but I don't see that it's provided any benefits in terms of increased angler trips or increased license sales, which were the promises that were supposed to come from that shift. Promoting the use of alternative gear, we were doing that research before this policy. As a matter of fact, our best alternative gear for spring Chinook isn't allowed anymore, and it's one of the best alternative gears of any fishery in terms of mortality rates on the river. and increasing production of offshore channels. We all know that nothing's happened in Washington. If you listen to the comments of the commissioners at that time in regards to that topic, they were several of them mentioned it was a good deal for Washington because Oregon was doing all the work and paying all the money, and there wasn't much expenditure for Washington. This policy has just been a failure. That's all there is to it. And to try to make it look better or to do anything small is just a waste of time because it didn't work, and it's not going to work. We had the tools in place, the abundance-based matrices that had been developed over a lot of years, the sharing that it provided a fishery for us and more fish for the public. All of that was in place. It was successful. Some groups weren't happy about it. But, I mean, that's the way all of these decisions are. You can listen to these conversations today. Not everybody's happy about things. But the policy has been a failure, and it's time to get out of that and get something that benefits everybody, including the public that owns the resource. You know, some of these have become public-only fisheries or sport-only fisheries with no public access, even though they pay for them. So in terms of pinnipeds, we know that on the Columbia River there's a lot of data about the damage that they cause. And we have, the states have been working hard. The new legislation of the government is going to help with that. It's not going to be a wholesale slaughter of animals. It's going to be a controlled thing if they use it. And we have the data on the Columbia. The transients don't come into the Columbia. And we have thousands of sea lions that are causing harm. So,
thanks, Robert. Yep. Commissioner McCaslick.
And thanks for your commitment on the bird censusing tomorrow. And let the record note that you're toward the end of the speakers here today, too. So you said that there was one alternative gear that is now disallowed. And I wondered what that is.
Yeah, well, our spring tangle nets, which we developed in 2001 and started using in 2002, are a very effective alternative gear for spring Chinook. A low mortality rate of released wild fish was very effective. We weren't able to use it as much as we should have been able to because a good portion of our allocation was delayed as a buffer until May when we at one point can't use them as well because the shad population in the river increases. But, you know, we have lots of good data on how good that those tangle nets are, but we don't have enough allocation anymore to even effectively use them. And so it's like there's two ways to kill us, to eliminate the gear or to just eliminate the allocation so we don't have enough fish to catch to use the gear. And essentially that's what this policy did to us. So
thanks, Robert. Have fun on the bird count tomorrow.
Yeah, it'll be more fun than testifying on the policy.
What? You hurt my feelings now. And Colleen, you're the last one for this part of the agenda.
Oh boy, all right. Thank you. My name is Colleen Weiler. I'm here on behalf of Whale and Dolphin Conservation. The Marine Mammal Protection Act, one of our nation's landmark environmental laws, is based on a series of groundbreaking principles. Most important among them is the recognition of marine mammals as vital and functional elements of their ecosystem and the need to protect them as such. The remarkable recovery of seals and sea lions along our coast and in the Salish Sea is a success story of the MMPA and should not be undermined by attempts to manage them through lethal removal. In the years before the MMPA, pinniped populations were severely depleted, and our Pacific Northwest Society does not know or has forgotten how to coexist with abundant and healthy populations of pinniped in a functional and natural ecosystem. There is no doubt that our ecosystem here has changed, with salmon and southern resident orcas declining and slipping toward extinction. But it is not beyond repair, and it did not reach this point because of seals and sea lions. The data from Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife shows that the abundance of harbor seals in the Salish Sea has leveled off or even declined in some areas, while salmon populations continue to fluctuate for a number of complex reasons. Blaming pinnipeds for eating salmon does not address the root causes of decline for salmon or southern resident orcas and is a distraction from the work that needs to be done to rebuild healthy runs of wild salmon in the Pacific Northwest, protecting and restoring habitat, addressing impacts from growing development and urbanization, stormwater and agricultural runoff, and reconnecting rivers and watersheds. the estimates of salmon consumption by harbor seals from a single year of data does not account for temporal, spatial, and annual variability in the diet of harbor seals, nor does it account for differences in nutritional needs and diet of different age and sex classes. Models are, by necessity, based on many assumptions that must simplify the complexities of ecosystem interactions. Much more information is needed on the variability in diets and what might impact predation and salmon survival before jumping to the easy answer of a lethal call. Seals and sea lions receive a lot of blame because they are highly visible and intelligent creatures who know when and where to go to find food, which is often the same places that humans go. The MMPA was designed to be precautionary, not reactive, and a cull of seals and sea lions is a reactionary approach to a problem that will take much more to fix. We should prioritize actions that address the fundamental causes of salmon decline instead of putting time, resources, and funding into band-aid precarious solutions with no long-term benefit or measurable outcomes. Seals and sea lions are not an invasive species and are not experiencing population explosions, but instead are bouncing back from decades of depletion. They are part of an ecosystem trying to return to a historical balance, providing food for big orcas and leveling out by reaching carrying capacity on their own without human interference. Recent polling has shown that 76% of Americans support protecting marine mammals from threats by human activities, and 73% support the MMPA. And in fact, the majority of public comments on the Washington State Southern Resident Orca Task Force directly opposed lethal removal or expressed concerns about attempts to alter the ecosystem. There, since we're out of time, and I'm the last one. So.
Thank you. Well, that's good timing. Thank you for coming all the way from Newport, Oregon, to share your opinions.
Yes, thank you for letting me talk.
Thank you. Well, thank you all. That was very informative.
Sir, I had it signed up for public comment.
Oh.
I might put it down on the wrong sheet or something, but if there's...
What's your name?
Rob
Crable,
Defenders
Wildlife. Yeah.
He probably signed up for another item.
Yeah, come on up, Rob. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't have it here. So.
That's okay. It may have been my fault. It's not the first time. Well, thank you so much, commissioners. As I said, my name's Rob Crable. I'm a Northwest representative with Defenders of Wildlife, and just wanted to quickly highlight a letter that I had sent to you all yesterday with some recommendations for how to implement several of the actions from the Orca Recovery Task Force. I was involved with the task force process in the Prey Working Group, which Dr. Penny Becker was a co-chair of, and her leadership was extremely instrumental in the development of those recommendations, and also enjoyed working with Chair Smith and Director Suslind on the task force. Specifically, I wanted to call to your attention that in the letter, we highlight a couple of other agencies that we think are very important for you to work with. So DNR, Puget Sound Partnership, and the Department of Ecology will be extremely important partners in identifying and setting concrete, measurable goals specifically for large-scale estuary and riparian habitat restoration and for identifying barriers to prioritize for removal. The system that we suggested for you in the letter on how to go about identifying and prioritizing barriers for removal is a system that Oregon uses. Right now, the phase one of this process is looking at just identifying which barriers are the biggest problem, and we really think that the department has an important role to play in assessing the biological benefits and costs to removing some of these barriers. Phase two will then be looking at some of the more socioeconomic implications as well, but we really encourage the department to look at the biology behind barrier removal. When it comes to hatcheries, we've been concerned with some of the emphasis placed on hatchery production. It's definitely a necessary short-term action to take for southern resident orcas, but we really think that the state should be assessing and developing plans long-term that phases out our reliance on hatcheries as we rebuild wild populations. So while we are pleased to see that there will be more fish out in the water, we would much rather see those be wild fish and encourage the department to focus on that. Lastly, when it comes to some of the predation, invasive fish behind dam reservoirs are a huge impact to juvenile salmon, and as they are non-native species, those are ones that we should definitely be targeting and working to remove. That's something that the department and I had talked to about developing some regulations around that, and I hope to work with staff and the commission on those regulations. And lastly, I would just like to echo some of the other comments that were made that while pinniped predation has been shown to be an issue, the solution has not yet really been fleshed out. It's not clear if lethal removal is the most appropriate way to restore and recover salmon, much less southern resident orcas. So before anyone jumps the gun, we highly recommend that the department works within the confines of the task force recommendation to pursue the science and support those efforts first. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. Yes, Commissioner McIsaac.
With regard to pinniped, the pinniped question out there, and several of the speakers have talked about that, and one mentioned a proposal for pinniped culling, and the idea of pinniped culling is one that is, to my knowledge, yet to be quite defined. The commission had a discussion about behavior modification at some point in time, but this has apparently become quite a source of dialogue around, and so I'll ask you, as the last speaker here, what proposal do you, are you aware of a particular proposal for culling, and when you hear the word culling proposal, do you think that that is a few animals, or is that 50% of the animals, or what do you think people are talking about when they say that?
It varies. And these were some of the very difficult questions that we talked about during our deliberations in the prey working group through the ORCA task force. It's clear that the removal of a handful of individuals may be something that is effective in some places, whereas other places you may need to do a huge, large-scale removal. But what is not clear is what the actual impact or benefit to salmon recovery is. And it's because there's still a lot of questions that we don't have answers to just yet. We also discussed some alternatives to culling and lethal removal, such as removing haul-out sites, changing how hatchery fish are distributed into the landscape. There's some theories that the large influx of juvenile smolts is just ringing a dinner bell for a lot of the pinnipeds. So there's a lot of questions out there that we just don't have answers to. Various scales as to one or two, or let's remove half of the population. It varies based on who you talk to. But I think the key thing is to get some of these answers first.
Thanks. Commissioner Grable.
Nice to see you back, Rob.
Yeah.
I know you've been absent for a little bit.
I've been running around at task force meetings. So.
And you mentioned the Oregon program. Now, we've had some meetings with Oregon, and I believe the director mentioned that they had probably removed over 350 animals, I believe. And then I've been meaning to ask, what do they do with the carcasses once these animals have been?
So the Oregon program I mentioned was in regards to the barrier analysis, not to the pinniped removal. When it comes to how Oregon deals with the carcasses, I'm not entirely sure. I know that there are some programs that grab them and take them to places like SeaWorld, but for the lethal removal, I'm not sure what they do.
Thank you, Rob.
That's an interesting question, because we have a 2,000-pound sea lion. Do you know, Kelly?
I don't know, but I'm sure Nate does and
okay.
Could cover that.
It's rendered.
It's rendered?
And it's very expensive.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. And there's been a number of mentions about the task force, and I want to embarrass a person in the room today who's been very important to the success of the task force. So Dr. Penny Becker has been a leader in all of this. Her name surfaced a few times, but having been at those meetings and seen the effective leadership that you brought forward in all of those, I appreciate it, and I thank you. With that, we will move into, and again, thank you all. That all of these comments were spot on today, and I learned a great deal, and I think we've taken a lot of notes. So. Yeah, we are